This podcast contains adult language and subject matter.
Nine overtime games so far in the Stanley Cup playoffs. The road team has won seven of the nine. As Joseph went down the ice there. Chance in front. Oh, what a save by the stick. Curtis Joseph got the paddle down on that one. He was out of position and rallied back to make the incredible save to keep it 3-0.
Curtis Joseph is both beloved and overlooked. Known simply to many as Cujo, he strung together a 19-year NHL career that featured stops in St. Louis, Edmonton, Toronto, Detroit, Phoenix, and Calgary. A late bloomer, Joseph was never supposed to make it, but he did, and he flourished in pressure situations, facing more rubber than his contemporaries. His puck-stopping style was old-school, but also new-age. He certainly had his fair share of raging moments on the ice, but, off it, he was strategic and chill. Joseph was the one who beat the longest odds. I'm John Mattis, and this is When Goalies Were Weird, a narrative podcast from The Score. Each episode tells the story of one unforgettable 1990s-era goalie. In the 90s, there was no more fascinating position in all of professional sports than the hockey goalie. These goalies were just plain weird. They played weird, with weird hybrid styles and funky mechanics. They looked weird, and acted weird, with weird helmets, superstitions, and bad tempers. The position was undergoing a revolution in style and substance, as the butterfly goalie replaced the stand-up while advancements in equipment technology helped usher in a modernized, more athletic playing style. The old guard's quirks and the new guard's innovations melded together to produce an era of pure chaos in the blue paint. It was the most bewildering amalgamation of players hockey has ever produced, and one fans will never forget. Curtis Joseph was born Curtis Monroe on April 29, 1967. Less than a week later, he was adopted by a nurse named Jan, who went on to marry Harold Joseph. Jan and Harold ran a psychiatric rehabilitation center in Sharon, Ontario, a small town north of Toronto. The family lived there, too. This unconventional arrangement, coupled with a lack of money, led to imperfect eating habits and sleeping quarters for young Joseph. As he wrote in his 2018 memoir, 10-year-old Joseph was living on a steady diet of stale cookies, processed cheese slice sandwiches, and frozen institutional hamburgers. He slept on an old mattress that often smelled of cat urine. Blankets were in short supply. Rags to riches doesn't quite do justice to Joseph's complicated story. Not when you consider the cost of playing competitive hockey, where having disposable income is a prerequisite for participation. Former teammate Kelly Chase provides some context.
Well, there's a saying in hockey when guys win Stanley Cups and get big contracts and they don't have great years, they say it's hard to eat when your belly's full. In Cujo's case, he slept on a mattress on the floor of a basement of an asylum. There's a motivation in there. I mean, I grew up on a farm in Saskatchewan and had no intention of being a farmer. And my dad passed away when I was young. And I know that internally for me, that's what drove me. That's what made me realize that the opportunities that were in front of me, there was only one person that could grab a hold of them. That was me. And I think Curtis, he was wired the same way. What did he have to fall back on?
Chase and Joseph met in the late 1980s in Peoria, Illinois, home of the St. Louis Blues' top farm team. Put aside for a moment what he accomplished in the NHL. Joseph appearing in even one pro hockey game would have counted as an astonishing feat, considering the obstacles he faced on the way to Peoria and the Blues organization. For starters, there were two distinct sides to Jan, who struggled with drug addiction. Joseph wrote in his book that his mom could be compassionate, but also mean, angry, and petty. Meanwhile, Harold, his dad, was nice enough, but neither affectionate nor fatherly. Hugging wasn't really a thing with his parents. Car rides to hockey? forget it. Jan had to be convinced by one of Joseph's stepsisters to let him play House League, the lowest rung on the minor hockey ladder. He started as a forward, but moved to the crease fairly early on. Hockey became a source of self-esteem and relationships. According to Tyler Stewart, Joseph's lifelong friend and a member of the rock band Bare Naked Ladies, Joseph's personality and demeanor simply endeared himself to others. In the absence of solid parenting, he was, in a sense, raised by a village.
A lot of people really looked out for him. You know, they gave him opportunities, whether that's driving him to places or having them stay with them while he was playing certain hockey leagues, coaches recommending him to other coaches. For a kid who was given up for adoption and adopted by a very unconventional family and growing up in challenging conditions, like, he was such a solid dude. You know, he became this really great human being. And I think that's why everybody wanted to help him out. So the combination of the community and his natural talent and personality got him everywhere.
By 16, the highest level Joseph had played was single A. Most 16-year-old Canadians with NHL aspirations are either well into a triple-A career or a rookie on a junior squad. In other words, Joseph was far, far away from being a legitimate prospect. He didn't even garner buzz as an 18-year-old when he jumped from Junior B to Junior A. But then he caught a break. Paul Saunders, a good Samaritan from Sharon, who had previously paid for some of Joseph's on-ice training, had a son who played football at a boarding school in Saskatchewan. The school, Notre Dame, boasted a junior hockey team too. In fact, it was one of the top programs in North America, and still is today. Saunders introduced Joseph to the Notre Dame staff and paid for Joseph's flight after negotiating a tryout. Joseph debated staying in Ontario, but ultimately said, "Ah, screw it, I'm going out west." He has noted this was the best decision he ever made. In Joseph's lone season at Notre Dame, he posted a .916 save percentage en route to a national title. The Hounds had a hell of a squad for that 1987-88 season. Joseph, future NHL superstar Rod Brind'Amour, and Scott Pellerin, a winger who played 11 NHL seasons. Willie Mitchell, the Hounds' other goalie and an Ontario kid as well, connected with Joseph right away. First, the duo tracked down pads to replace Joseph's ancient set. Then, Mitchell watched the new guy find himself and his confidence in the crease.
Coaches would talk to him in Toronto and then blow him off forever and had no interest. And when he came here, they're looking at him all of a sudden that, oh my gosh, this team's legit. He's legit. We used to have 10, 15 scouts in NHL scouts at our practices. Okay. Cause Rod Brind'Amour was predicted in the top five, and they'd be looking at Curtis saying, what's going on here? You know, and then he became the highest free agent signing out of college that following year. So they knew what they were watching. I think that gave him confidence. Once you have confidence as a goaltender, that's all you need.
Joseph's strong play resulted in significant NCAA interest and eventually a scholarship at the University of Wisconsin. He then recorded a stellar .919 save percentage in 39 games for the Badgers. As Mitchell mentioned, his play at Notre Dame in Wisconsin snowballed into an entry-level contract with the Blues as an undrafted free agent. Here's Dwayne Dirksen, a fellow Wisconsin netminder, on Joseph's rise to the NHL.
You see all these kids that go and play in a Pee Wee tournament in Quebec, and there's teams from all over the world, the best young players. And as they say, there's only a 0.0125% chance you're going to make it to the NHL as a hockey player in minor hockey. I don't think he ever gave up. And once he was given an opportunity, he definitely seized it. Things happened really fast. So he just latched onto that, saw what that could do and make him eventually to have a very successful career and make a good living.
Joseph's minor hockey odyssey is a lesson in perseverance. He could have opted to drop out of high school and work at a factory to pay the bills, but he didn't, because he couldn't shake the urge to chase the NHL, where he would star for almost two decades. After splitting his first pro season between the IHL and NHL, Joseph entered the big leagues for good at 23 years old and didn't retire until 42. Yep, that's a good living. Chase is drawn to the never quit aspect of Joseph's arc as a player.
He didn't have the support that a lot of us have from a family perspective, and certainly didn't have the money if he'd fallen out of hockey, if he had an injury or whatever it might be, you know, he was on his own. So I think that's what drove him to be successful more than anything. He used that as an internal motivator to make him successful. He wasn't a junior player that everyone had great recognition for. He had to go to Notre Dame to be successful. It was way out of his element. He loved it there, but he didn't know anything about it. So he was going to make a name for himself because of his inner competitiveness. And I think that's what's the most admirable thing about what Curtis Joseph is about.
During his career, the full scope of Joseph's backstory wasn't revealed to the public. Close friends, including some teammates, knew tidbits, but not the entire picture. Joseph didn't share the bulk of it until the release of his book. Former Phoenix Coyotes teammate Ed Jovanovski respects Joseph immensely for avoiding the woe-is-me trap people who have endured a troubled upbringing can easily fall into. More importantly, he respects Joseph for turning a negative into a positive.
You hear the stories where people struggle in their childhood and they just go down a real slippery slope. It might not be anything to do with them. It's just something that they just, listen, can't cope with it or didn't get the right help at the time or just didn't have any resources to go down, you know, that helpful road. But I always look at people that got in trouble and then turned their life around and turned out to be really upstanding citizens that give back. From what I saw and what I've been around, he's that giving guy, happy-go-lucky guy that I think is just like all of us, appreciative of kind of where we are today and what hockey has given us and the friendships that we've created and the structure that we've learned and the discipline and the hard work, all those characteristics on what we want to pass on to our children.
The fans, I think they like it, even though it's going against the Blues. Here we go. Donnelly against the goaltender Joseph. He shoots. Saved by Curtis Joseph.
Curtis Joseph believed he could have grown to be taller if his parents had fed him properly. Listed at 5'11", he was about average height for his generation of goalies. Joseph instead stood out by essentially playing like a superhuman street hockey goalie. Former NHL goalie and Missouri native Mike McKenna grew up watching Joseph live at the old St. Louis Arena. He saw an intelligent, athletic battler in the home team's crease.
He didn't have a lot of coaching. He taught himself a lot of this. And so when you have somebody that's as gifted of an athlete as him and somebody who thinks the game at a very fast, clear level, creativity and acrobatic saves, they tend to just come out. They almost reflect your personality in some of those ways. And he was cerebral, but he just had kind of that whimsy to his game of still playing street hockey at times. And that's when you'd really see it come out. And that's what makes the game so much fun to watch, even if today's game, when somebody windmills or stacks the pads or just does something you don't see very often anymore, you just go back to playing street hockey or playing in the basement with your friends. I feel like that, again, his youth is really what seemed to serve him in those moments later on, from what I saw at least.
Joseph, in St. Louis and elsewhere over his career, deployed a hybrid goaltending style, a mix of the old-school stand-up and new-school butterfly. He played the angles and percentages, attempting to get as much of himself as possible between puck and net. McKenna remarked that Joseph wasn't married to one way of approaching incoming shot attempts. He might challenge a shooter by skating out to the face-off circle, and then in the next sequence, be positioned deep in his crease, only a foot or two off the goal line. It all depended on the variables, quality of shooter, defensive coverage, and the like. Along the way, Joseph helped usher in the paddle down, a goaltending stance typically used to ward off wraparound tries and other scoring chances from awkward angles. In the paddle down, the goalie's stick and one of his pads are on the ice protecting the bottom of the net. The top is left exposed. However, since the shooter is in such close proximity to the goalie, it's difficult for them to raise the puck high enough to score. McKenna, who retired in 2019, breaks down why the paddle down worked for Joseph.
It's funny now because paddle down we don't like to use because you give up space up top and it's not as effective on higher shots and quicker game and blah, blah, blah. Well, back then people didn't shoot the puck as well. When they'd get in tight, pads didn't seal the ice like they do now. Pads seal the ice the whole length now. They didn't used to. So I really looked at Cujo as one of the first guys with paddle down that made it work a lot. Belfour used it a lot. Potvin, somewhat. But Cujo really, to me, kind of defined that and gave young goaltenders, especially from my era, another tool in their box.
Another quirk. Joseph possessed an internal index of tape jobs. As in, he could instantly recognize an opposing puck carrier solely by his stick tape color and the pattern in which the stick was taped. This was part of Joseph's charm as the ultimate thinking man's goalie. And it helps explain how he developed his wonderfully awkward puck-moving technique. Joseph caught with his left hand, but struggled to handle the puck in a normal fashion with a left-handed stick. So, one day he decided to start moving the puck on his backhand. After hundreds of reps in practice, he had polished it enough for game use. From there, he showcased the unique technique fairly often. Actually, that may be underselling it. Joseph learned to backhand the puck to the red line like nobody's business. It was efficient and smooth. He resembled a football quarterback. Or, as ex-Toronto Maple Leafs forward Mike Johnson remembers it, Joseph was a puck-moving maestro.
We'd be 5-on-5 or killing a penalty, and somebody would dump it in, and Cooj would stop the puck behind the net, and you'd see him flip his hand over, so his catcher would be on the knob, and his blocker would be down by the middle of the stick, and he'd be getting ready to do a big scooper, and he could just drop them out in center just so perfectly. And we would joke, we'd be having like a forward line meeting out of the red line waiting for him to drop one in our breadbasket for a breakaway because he had this high scooper where he took a deficiency because he couldn't shoot the puck on his forehand, but he was a maestro with his backhand lob shot. I think I scored, honestly, 2 or 3 goals in those couple of years playing with him, just skating out to center, grabbing a puck that he high flips for breakaways and going in and scoring.
Strategizing was a joy for Joseph. He would talk shop for hours on end with teammates, most notably Blues star Brendan Shanahan and Coyotes captain Shane Doan. Former Leafs defenseman Corey Cross recalls several in-depth conversations. On a 2-on-1, Joseph once said to the 6'5" Cross, "Why don't you go down early to force the shooter to try to pass over you?" This went against conventional wisdom. Normally, a goalie prefers to focus on the shooter while the D-man takes care of the second attacker. With shot blocking, Joseph liked when his teammates stood up straight and squeezed their arms against their body. In Joseph's mind, this reduced the number of funny bounces off equipment and also allowed him to concentrate on covering certain parts of the net. Forward Dean McCammon was around for the entirety of Joseph's 3-year tenure with the Edmonton Oilers. Looking back, McCammon says a major takeaway from their time together is a piece of advice Joseph dished out during a quiet moment in practice.
I remember the one time it came down, he was giving me all glove hand in practice. After I shot there and he just moved over and made the save, it was like, you know, what's this guy doing? Like, he's not squaring up. He's just cheating, right? And I remember him saying to me, well, if you ain't cheating, you ain't trying. And that's one phrase that I actually use with my players that when I was coaching. He wasn't a cheater off the ice, but on the ice, you know, like you cheat on faceoff, you try and get an advantage.
Johnson, who not only played with Joseph in Toronto, but also in Arizona for one season, had a similar experience. Joseph may have been on the back nine of his career when the two crossed paths in the desert, but he wasn't afraid to instruct or teach.
He was maybe not quite the only, but the most prominent goalie willing to talk about scoring and stuff in practice. Like, he would talk about how I'm doing or when I'm shooting, what he's seeing, and maybe try this or think about that, or goalies struggle with this, and this is a trickier one. He wasn't just worried about his job, stopping pucks, practicing, doing his thing, which of course is enough to fill anyone's day and mind. He would talk to you and work it through with you and kind of break it down from a goalie's perspective for you as the shooter or even as a defender. I was a penalty killer. He's like, hey, I want to see this. I want to see that. If you give me this shot, I will save it every time. Don't let him take this. Like, he was very much a coach. Kind of in all areas, he was a guy who just, he helped your confidence in yourself and in the team's success.
Johnson, now a broadcaster for various media outlets, added that Joseph was approachable on game day, unlike most members of the goaltending fraternity. Overall, was he, for lack of a better term, less of an island than other netminders?
100%. That is a great way to put it, less of an island. Players in the dressing room instinctively pick up on whatever the goaltender needs. Some guys don't want to be bothered on game day. Sometimes some guys don't literally want you to talk to them on game day. Some guys will get mad if you ever raise a puck past their knees in a practice. And so when he's your starter and he's really, really good, you don't shoot high on him in practice. Like, that's just how it evolves. But Cooge was not like that. Probably some of it, well, a lot of it's just how Cujo was as a person and how he was wired. Probably some of it came from humbler beginnings where he wasn't, you know, a first round pick and he came out of college and had to prove himself and work his way up. And maybe part of it is that for him to be successful, he also felt like he had to be collaborative because he wasn't just a blocking kind of goaltender, a butterfly guy. Like, he had to be an athlete, read and react, and in many ways be on the same page as his teammates.
Two Capitals on Luke Shen, but he's able to get it outside the line. Mike Green will bring it right back in. Green, great pass, and a better stop by Joseph Nair.
He's in the zone.
Is he ever?
He is clearly in the zone.
There's Backstrom. Green, step to the net. Joseph, stop to Nowitzki. Stop by Joseph. Back-to-back stops. Off two guys with a combined 32 power play goals on the year.
Professional athletes need to unwind, to take their mind off the grind. Golf is a popular outlet for NHLers. Some guys might seek passive entertainment, like video games or movies. Others start a side business. Curtis Joseph was drawn to horses, of all things. Don Meehan, the longtime NHL agent, introduced Joseph to horse racing in the early 90s, and it wasn't long before Joseph advanced beyond the passing interest phase. Joseph would research endlessly and eventually purchased a few racehorses. Glenn Healy backed up Joseph from 1998 to 2001. He heard plenty about Joseph's hobby during, shall we say, fascinating post-game flights on the Maple Leafs plane.
I would sit beside Corey Cross. And Corey Cross was one of those guys who had this 800-page military book that he liked to read. And beside Corey Cross was Curtis Joseph. So Curtis and I would have lots of conversations on the flights. I was a bagpiper. So I'm sitting with my practice chanter and my bagpipe music in front of me, and I'm playing bagpipe music on an electronic dagger pipe chanter so no one could hear, so that they wouldn't kill me on the plane. And Curtis was all into horses. And what conversations we would have between Corey Cross talking about Rommel in the war, me talking about bagpipes and their effect in the war, and Curtis, who loved horses, talking about, if you took a little bit of semen from this horse and mixed it with that horse. And I thought to myself, if Toronto fans knew what we were talking about on the way back from games, they would be absolutely floored.
There's a poetic link between Joseph's infatuation with horses and his career. He himself was a workhorse between the pipes. For the bulk of his career, he started a large chunk of his team's games, often shouldering a heavy nightly load. From Notre Dame to retirement, Joseph faced a ton of shots at almost every single stop along the way. Case in point, Joseph's team ranked in the bottom half of the league in shots against per game in 13 of his 19 NHL seasons. Over a three-year stretch in St. Louis, from 91 to 94, the Blues allowed 34 shots a night. That is, to put it kindly, a porous defensive structure. Keep in mind, too, Joseph's teams were usually competitive, with 15 of 19 earning postseason berths. So it wasn't a talent problem. It was style of play. Joseph's teams tended to play high-risk, high-reward hockey, and he thrived in hectic environments. According to HockeyReference.com, Joseph faced 40 or more shots in a total of 78 regular season games in the 1990s. That total, which basically equals a full season for an NHL team, led the league by 17 games. Joseph's record in those 78 games? 36, 25, and 17. And, like clockwork, Joseph would stand on his head virtually every spring. In the first round of the 92-93 playoffs, for instance, he led the underdog Blues to a sweep of the mighty Chicago Blackhawks. St. Louis then pushed Toronto to 7 games in the second round, thanks in large part to Joseph, who made 61 saves in a double overtime game 1 and 57 in a double overtime game 2. Former Blues defenseman Robert Dirk reflects on Joseph's main stage presence.
When he got in the zone, some of his playoff games, you saw it, 50, 60, 70 saves. How do you do that? You got to be that good to be able to do it, but you got to have that confidence and mojo and he had it. As good as he was, I don't think, especially the hockey fans today, we don't really understand how good he was. Pretty underrated because he didn't win a Stanley Cup.
That's the catch with Joseph. Somehow, he never played in a Stanley Cup final. In Edmonton, chasing a championship was pure fantasy. The mid to late 90s Oilers were a small market club, barely getting by financially, with the exchange rate for the Canadian dollar in shambles. This was before the salary cap. Captain Kelly Buchberger said there was no question Joseph was team MVP during those lean years. And it's impossible to disagree after sifting through old game logs and tape. Edmonton, the seventh seed in the 96-97 playoffs, defeated the second-seeded Dallas Stars in seven games to advance to the second round. Joseph, then 30 years old, put up a .932 save percentage in two shutouts, including a 47-save performance in Game 5. The plucky Oilers became an overnight cult favorite, or everybody's temporary second-favorite team, following Joseph's diving stop on Joe Nieuwendyk in Game 7.
And he was turned around. Here's Sidor racing in. He's around the net trying to come out. You cannot believe that save by Curtis Joseph.
Joseph's encore? Stymieing another high seed, again in seven games, in the first round of the 97-98 postseason. The Oilers rallied back from being down 3-1 in the series against the Colorado Avalanche, with Joseph finishing with an unreal shutout streak of 163 minutes and 40 seconds. McCammond, the gritty ex-Oilers forward, reflects on that Avs series.
For us to approach Colorado, I mean, they had a star-studded team from, you know, Sackett to Forsberg to Lemieux, and like all their defense with Blake and Foot and, of course, Patty Waugh and Nanette. And Patrick Waugh was one of the greats at the time. It was like when you're looking on the ice of these, well, they've got Patrick Waugh. Well, who cares? We've got Curtis Joseph. I wouldn't be thinking that we're outmanned in net in our end. So those are the types of thoughts that you had. So you felt like you had a chance.
Anyone who's ever played hockey at any age or skill level can relate to the feeling McCammon just described. Having full trust in your goalie is paramount to success. Coaches love to feel it as well. Pat Quinn, Joseph's bench boss in Toronto, trusted his puck stopper enough to give Leaf skaters the freedom to play a freewheeling brand of hockey. The style change unlocked a new level in the group, as the Leafs vaulted from 69 points in 97-98 to 97 points in 98-99, Joseph's first year suiting up for his hometown team. Joseph, who was spectacular later that debut season during a first-round playoff meeting with the Philadelphia Flyers, went on to terrorize Toronto's provincial rival, the Ottawa Senators. The Battle of Ontario, which at the time was headlined by franchise icons Matt Sundin and Daniel Alfredson, as well as a long list of memorable teammates, ended the same way 3 years in a row. The Leafs, victorious. The Sens, despondent. It would be lazy to suggest Joseph was the X factor every game. But over the course of three series, nobody's cumulative performance compared to that of the Leafs goalie. Back then, Healy says, Toronto's players would be handed a printed stat sheet following games. The sheet highlighted the amount of time the puck spent in each zone of the ice.
Those games against Ottawa, in a 60-minute game, they would be in our zone for 42 minutes. That's an incredible amount of time to let guys like Alfredson and Yashin and that group of skilled players have the puck in your zone. And so we would sit together on the bus and we would have the sheet at the end of the game. And it was quite funny to listen to the other guys talking about how they had shut down Alexei Yashin at the faceoff dot. And the checking job we did on that top line was exceptional tonight. And I would look at Curtis and say, you got to be kidding me. Like, they're in our zone for 48 minutes. You shut them down. So the Ottawa Senators deserved a better fate. And if the Ottawa fans are to hate anybody, don't hate the whole Maple Leaf team. Just hate Curtis Joseph, because he was the guy who made a difference. He was our ace in the hole and our Bauer card in a game of euchre.
Joseph didn't win the Vezina during his time in Toronto, or anywhere for that matter, but he was essential in getting the Leafs to two Eastern Conference Final Series in a four-year span. It's the franchise's most successful run in the past quarter century. We brought up road hockey earlier, how Joseph's unorthodox style, born out of a lack of training as a kid, projected some serious road hockey vibes. Well, Healy has a mini sticks analogy to share, and it cuts to the heart of what made Joseph tick.
It's you against me, and I'm putting my money on me because I think I'm better than you. It's like two kids that are in the hallway of a silver stick tournament with the mini sticks, and you throw down the roll of tape or the sock and you say, okay, which one's the better player? I'll tell you which one, the one who wants the ball more. That's the intangible side of the game that Curtis had. He didn't want to get beat at any time, at any place, by any player.
It goes high by Cross, Cross to land. Pass in there with Alfredson going to the net. Zadar shoots!
Joseph's got to take it easy here, and some teammates should get between him and the referee. In his attempt to argue the point, he knocked the referee down.
Curtis Joseph's college nickname was the Cat. His teammates thought he was quote-unquote as quick as a cat in the crease. Okay, easy to remember, rationale checks out, not bad. One problem. By the time Joseph had established himself as a pro in the early 90s, the NHL already had its cat goalie in Felix Potvin, a hotshot second-round pick of the Leafs. And there went the momentum Curtis the Cat Joseph had built up at Wisconsin. Early in Joseph's tenure with the Blues, though, a brainstorming session between veteran teammates spit out a more original moniker, Cujo. Dirk, the former defenseman we heard from earlier, is credited with coming up with the nickname.
As we're getting to know guys and we're giving each other nicknames, it's just like, well, what do we call them? Curtis, Josie, like, we just couldn't come up with anything. And I remember I was with Kelly Chase and Dave Tomlinson. We were out at dinner or out somewhere or over at somebody's house. What are we going to do? Well, what are we going to do with this guy? Like, what are we going to call him? He just came to me that we combined C and U and J and O and Cujo because of Stephen King's book and movie. We sort of looked at each other and go, yeah, that ain't bad. And sort of stuck.
Chase remembers Joseph smirking as he heard the Cujo nickname for the first time, which is a pretty amusing image, given how unassuming Joseph can be off the ice. The Cujo nickname and the connection to King's 1981 horror novel was a terrific alliance, something a big city marketing agency might spend days workshopping. I suppose not everyone would be comfortable with being associated with a rabid St. Bernard like the one depicted in King's book. Yet, Joseph embraced it, wholeheartedly. His goalie mask, for one, saw a major facelift. It went from a cartoonish design based around trumpets and music notes to a rugged design featuring a bloodthirsty dog. Joseph kept this brand, if you will, alive for his whole career. He's so synonymous with the nickname that people, fans, media, teammates, coaches, rarely call him Curtis Joseph. He's Cujo, and that easily identifiable mask is without question a work of art. On the ice, the angry dog inside Joseph would surface here and there. Joseph wasn't a loose cannon, by any means, but there were flashes of aggression. Infamously, an incensed Joseph accidentally toppled referee Mick Magoo while arguing a non-call during a game against the Senators in the 99-2000 playoffs. The 34-year-old tossed his trapper and blocker before wiping out at Magoo's feet. Cross, the former Leafs blue liner, had the best possible view for the all-time blooper.
Well, that was my fault. Alfredson was going to the net, and I kind of ride him into Cujo, knocks him off balance, the puck goes in. I feel horrible because I knew I kind of cost the goal. And then I just look over and there's Cujo going crazy. And I just like, oh, no. Unfortunately, he slipped and fell and knocked over the ref. So it looked worse than he wanted to. You know, he just wanted to make a point. And obviously, he was pretty rattled that they scored. But he just totally slipped. That was an interesting little moment. And, yeah, it was totally my fault.
In his book, Joseph equated the entire Magoo fiasco to road rage, He was indignant over the officiating, and he lost control of his emotions in the heat of the moment. It didn't help, he wrote, that his skates were in desperate need of sharpening. 5 years later, one of Joseph's teammates and good friends, Shane Doan, found himself in hot water. Doan had been accused of making disparaging remarks about French Canadians, following a game between the Coyotes and Montreal Canadiens. Discourse over the incident returned 2 years later, and it evolved into a full-blown national controversy. A group of Canadian politicians demanded Doan be stripped of his captaincy at the 2007 World Championships. It was a mess. For the record, it was one giant misunderstanding, as Doan didn't actually make disparaging remarks about anyone. Anyway, as Doan explains, the whole debacle started with the affable captain trying to relax his crazy goalie. Joseph would not stop giving it to the officials over a penalty call.
Try to appease him a little bit. Like, I knew why he was mad, but the game was over and the play had happened a while before that. It wasn't like a bang, bang play that we were all, you know, couldn't believe it. Anyways, he was fired up. And so he came out and I just say, hey, Cooge, four French refs in Montreal, we're probably not going to win this argument. Let's get off the ice here. Calm down, big man. Like, let's go. Anyways, yep. Cujo was the start of the whole thing.
There's that Cujo the rabid dog side of Joseph again. He would also sometimes tip over the Gatorade tub in the Leafs' dressing room to make a statement after a bad loss. He once threw a chair in the coach's room in St. Louis. Though, to be fair, scores of players clashed with bench boss Mike Keenan over the years. As for fights, Joseph fought a skater in college, according to Dirksen. There's no video evidence online, unfortunately. However, footage of Joseph's lone NHL fight, a 1993 beatdown of Detroit Red Wings goalie Tim Chevalde, isn't hard to find.
And everybody pairs up. It's out of control. McCrimmon's down on the ice. Zombo. Here comes Chevalde. He'll be thrown out of the game. Chevalde. Now Joseph gets into it. Curtis Joseph grabs Chevalde. And the two goalies go at it.
Chase, who sparked the line brawl, says Joseph became a Blues legend that night.
We joke about it a lot. Every year on the date of that game, you'll see those highlights come up on social media. If we have a game against Detroit, that highlight is played on the Jumbotron. It's an epic moment for Curtis Joseph because if the fans didn't love him already, he certainly endeared himself to them after that. There was nowhere Curtis Joseph was going to go where he couldn't get a free beer or free meal. They loved him in the city of St. Louis just for his fortitude, but he was a character guy and they realized that that night, and he was a blue collar guy that fit right in with the city of St. Louis.
As I alluded earlier, off the ice, Joseph was humble and kind. He wouldn't hurt a fly, says Dirksen, who used the word gentle to describe his college goaltending partner. Jovanovski chose the word calm. Nothing seemed to bother Joseph, and he was never really in a rush. It was no biggie if after practice Joseph missed the team bus and had to take a cab or walk back to the hotel. Whatever. And if a group of Coyotes players were taking in the sights on the road, he'd go with the flow, do what the group wanted to do. Joseph was a quiet leader, says McCammond. To expand, he busts out a story involving a payback prank he played on an Oilers teammate during a commercial flight. The prank earned McCammon more attention than he wanted, but his pal Joseph was there to help make sense of the situation.
So I wake up and my tie is cut. I was told who it was. So when that player, I knew he was going to fall asleep on the road trip home. When he fell asleep, I took his suit coat out of his storage bin above him and I cut all the buttons off and cut the lining out of his suit coat. And it wasn't a huge deal because there's a tailor that did all our stuff in Edmonton, and I knew he could get it fixed. But there was a lady in the commercial flight that was really upset about it, and she was actually scolding me for doing that. Now, I'm a young player, right, 22 years old, and it was like, oh, okay, well, maybe I shouldn't be doing that or whatever. But after, I remember sitting beside Cooge, and he was helping me just categorize it like, you know, we do a lot for people. And he was like, don't stress that. He would talk to me like almost like a brother, not necessarily just a teammate, but very, very down to earth and very approachable. For his profile, I really appreciated Cooch for how he treated me at that time.
Reporters typically want to speak with the starting goalie of an NHL team multiple times a week. For many netminders, this dynamic can be annoying, a burden. Joseph didn't mind the extra responsibility, even in hockey mad markets like Edmonton and Toronto, where the temperature is always turned up on the club's star players. Healy puts it this way: Joseph was a great ambassador for the sport. Full stop. Former Leafs forward Todd Warner played two seasons with Joseph. He says Joseph was about as normal as they come. In other words, his behavior wasn't very goalie-like.
I played with a couple of dozen goalies at that level. I mean, I don't think any of them were maybe less quirky or less routine-oriented, as easy to be around as Cooch. I can't think of one off the top of my head. Everybody has their own patterns and things that happen around the rink, idiosyncrasies that they adhere to pretty religiously. I would say Cujo probably had some, but it wasn't obvious. Wasn't weird. He was he was always in the room. He was always talking. He was easy to be around. There was no drama.
Joseph was charitable too. In 2000, he won the NHL's King Clancy Memorial Trophy for best exemplifying leadership qualities on and off the ice and making a significant contribution to the community. Joseph had a passion for children's causes, donating a private box for home games and buying an anesthesia machine for Toronto's Sick Kids Hospital. At home, he had six kids of his own. He also helped raise a nephew. Stuart, the childhood friend and musician, labels Joseph a quote-unquote pretty regular dude. It's hard to dispute that, all things considered. Still, he must do something strange.
The only thing I would say is that I never saw a guy not give his kids a break on the ice as much as him. Whenever he'd play shinny or whatever with his own kids, he'd be like wiring slap shots. If his son was in net or if he was in net, he wouldn't give them any quarter. I remember being on his homemade rink up in King City once, and I was like aghast at the velocity with which he was firing slap shots at his son, Tristan. I was like, what's going on here? Because I know, man, he's got to know what it's like. Because he's so athletic, he wanted his kids to be like that too, I guess. But that's really the only thing. I mean, it's not cruelty or anything. It's just this kind of competitiveness.
You were very popular here in Toronto and beloved by the community. When you look back at your time here and then leaving Toronto, do you have any regret about leaving?
Yeah, I wouldn't have signed in Detroit. I would have stayed here. Everything was great. I was playing fantastic. But I think my ego may have got in the way, and I thought I could go win a cup and come back. I mean, it's craziness to think that you thought you were that good that you wouldn't be replaced, you know. So, I wouldn't have left Toronto.
There are two substantial what-ifs in Curtis Joseph's career. The first: what if the New Jersey Devils had welcomed Joseph into the fold in 1991? Joseph was part of a compensation package offered to New Jersey after St. Louis signed restricted free agent Brendan Shanahan to an offer sheet. However, Devils general manager Lou Lamoriello wasn't overly interested in the package, so Lamoriello took the matter to arbitration and was instead awarded defenseman Scott Stevens, not Joseph, Rod Brind'Amour, and draft capital. The Devils won cups in 1995, 2000, and 2003. The second what-if: what if Joseph's tenure with the Detroit Red Wings had gone smoother? Joseph was only with the Wings, the NHL's model franchise during his career, for 2 years. His quest to claim that elusive cup ring didn't materialize, in part because Joseph wasn't accustomed to Detroit's ability to limit shots against. He liked being busy. In the postseason, Joseph lost epic goalie battles against Jean-Sébastien Giguère in the first round of the 02-03 playoffs and Mika Kiprusoff in the second round in 03-04. For what it's worth, Johnson doesn't blame Joseph for either of those results.
Detroit had a couple tough exits of the playoffs, and everyone's like, well, Cujo can't win with Detroit. I'm like, did you see the stats? He had like a 945 save percentage. They just lost to Calgary because Kipper had a 980. Like, it's not his fault they didn't score. The hockey gods conspired against him those couple of years in Detroit where it just wasn't meant to be for him to win. But I don't think to know him, to play with him, to have been around the league, to play against those other goaltenders that had won cups and are considered some of the greatest of all time, he belongs in that conversation. He absolutely does.
As Johnson hints, unlike the Waz and Hasek of his generation, Joseph is not in the Hockey Hall of Fame. The calculus for him being kept out of the hall goes something like this. No cup, no cup final appearance, and no Vezina trophy equals no hall call. The pro hall argument, on the other hand, is strong. It just requires a deeper dive. Joseph ranked fourth all-time in wins when he retired. He's seventh now. Joseph also owned the most regular season wins and playoff wins among goalies without a cup. Roberto Luongo now holds that distinction, with Joseph sitting third behind Henrik Lundqvist. Joseph had longevity and adapted well. He was the first goalie to post 30-plus wins in a single season with five different teams, and the first goalie to win a playoff game with five different teams. He didn't always have cup-worthy support around him, which is not his fault. Meanwhile, Joseph was named a Vezina finalist on multiple occasions in a golden era for NHL goaltending, finishing third in 92-93 voting, second in 98-99, and third in 99-2000. In the playoffs, he crafted a career save percentage of .917. Very good for the era. The Hall of Fame has an exceptionally high bar for goalies, as only seven male netminders have been inducted since 1993. Joseph is part of a group of modern goalies who've arguably been overlooked, Tom Barrasso and Mike Vernon among them. What does McKenna, the goalie expert, think about the Hall snubbing Joseph?
I can't square that, but I also understand it. People don't get goalies. They don't. They're hesitant to, you know, you're the first guy blamed. You're the first guy who gets too much credit. A lot of times we're a little bit less important than people realize. But how do you not celebrate somebody that's got 454 wins in the NHL? How is that guy not in the Hall of 454 wins? You know, that is unbelievable. I think he's a glaring omission. I do think there's others as well that really plays into the goalie aspect. But to me, if there's anybody that's not sitting in the hall right now that belongs there, I mean, he's in the top three of those guys for sure for goaltenders in my eyes.
The narrative that says he can't win the big game was bolstered by Joseph's poor showing in the biggest game of his international career. Joseph was awarded an Olympic gold medal with Team Canada in 2002. However, in Salt Lake City, he lost the starting goalie job to Martin Brodeur after allowing 5 goals on 25 shots in the tournament opener. At any rate, if Healy were on the Hall of Fame selection committee, Joseph would be an automatic nominee for induction. As Joseph's ex-goalie partner, Healy's clearly biased. That said, he makes a salient point about number 31's underrated consistency.
As a backup goaltender, when I was in the league, I'd always look at the schedule and say, aha, okay, on this particular Thursday, 4 games in 6 nights, I'm going to have to be ready to play this game. And so when it came to backing Cujo up, and I would think, okay, tonight's the night, he's got to be tired. We were assaulted pretty much every night we played. He was our best player next to Mats. And yet he would put in a sterling performance, and I would think, well, I guess I'll keep my powder dry for the next one because I don't know if I'll get a next one, but just exceptionally consistent, incredible skill.
Joseph was a low-maintenance NHLer with high integrity, an easy guy to cheer for. In his book, Joseph said that he wouldn't change a thing about his life journey because it made him who he was. It made him tough, driven, appreciative. There was no direction to go but up, right? He wrote, every day, everything kept getting better and better. That disposition is precisely why Joseph's legacy extends far beyond stopping pucks.
You don't have to be the silver spoon guy who's drafted in the first round. You can be a non-drafted player. You don't have to be the guy who starts playing hockey at 3, who's very gifted, or plays golf at 3, like Tiger Woods did. You don't have to be that guy. You could be the guy who loves to play and starts playing goal at 13 because you like the position. And you don't have to have all this expectation on you to accomplish what would be an incredible Hall of Fame career. And so when people tell you that you can't, there's a great life story that tells you you can. For all the people that discounted Curtis and said, well, he's too small, he's not going to make it, he started too late, he didn't have the right upbringing, he didn't have the right equipment, he didn't listen to any of it. There was an intangible side of fire in him that was going to make it, so he was going to show people, I can. Dream your dreams, dream them big, and accomplish what you want, and not what other people think you should want.
When Goalies Were Weird is a podcast by The Score. Nick Roy is the audio engineer. Nick Ferris is a reporter and researcher. Guy Spurrier is an editor and producer. And Rory Bars is an editor and the executive producer. Thank you for listening.